Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Grace Colon, Chris Garabedian, and Tim Oppler. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So Novartis announced this week it plans to acquire MorphoSys for $2.9 billion, not including marketed lymphoma antibody Monjuvi. The drug at the center of the acquisition is pelabresib, a late-stage BET inhibitor for myelofibrosis. Pelabresib recently met key measures in a phase 3 myelofibrosis trial, and an NDA is planned for the second half of this year. MorphoSys is over 30 years old. So our colleague Bruce Booth noted that Atlas was a founding investor in some of those, you know, 20-year plus overnight success stories, including Horizon, Momenta, RQ, Lactilion, Alnylam, and Exelixis, the last two still being independent companies. And an interesting point from BioCentury is that MorphoSys has had a long history of generating thousands of monoclonal antibodies, but the acquisition was ultimately driven by two small molecules. So while the deal sounds like a win-win, there are some potential caveats on whether it will close. I don't know if you guys saw this, but Adam Feierstein at Stat put out an article before the deal terms were announced, and he apparently spoke to some sources within Novartis asserting that the deal would not close, citing that the deal structure enables early termination by Novartis if FDA doesn't clear the drug NDA for review. And these sources said that there was some skepticism within Novartis as to whether FDA would clear the application based on both mixed results from the phase 3 trial and a perspective that combination drugs face a tougher approval bar. Additionally, the article asserted that the termination fee was relatively low compared with most acquisitions. Once the deal terms were made public, though, someone pointed out that $100 million euro breakup fee isn't insignificant. I guess if they choose to walk away based on negative FDA feedback, 100 million euros isn't, you know, is not that bad for, you know, it's very different from a $3 billion acquisition. It's sort of like, I guess, a free call option. So I'm curious here what the rest of you guys think, if anybody's been watching the arb trading around the deal.
Not so much the arb trading, but we've definitely debated the merits of the drug and, you know, whether the incremental effect on top of JAK inhibition is particularly robust, whether it's sufficient for FDA approval. Cases can certainly be made in both directions. And I think given that uncertainty, given the structure of the deal, you would certainly expect a fairly wide spread between where the stock is and the acquisition bid.
Yeah, I also always wonder when you see these leaks, you know, we talked about these leaks with regard to acquisitions, but this particular one, it almost sounded like somebody from Novartis or that were against the deal or in some way, you know, trying to sabotage it or I don't know what, but in my opinion, you know, it shows a little bit of questionable integrity on the part of whoever it is that's leaking this information. You know, you're part of a team, and if you don't like how decisions are made, leave, but don't do like political stuff like this. So that's my own opinion. Curious to hear what others think. And Tim, would love to also talk about the IPO market. You know, we had another strong IPO with Kyverna this week. Can we officially say that the IPO window is back open?
The IPO market's definitely back open. And, you know, I think I talked a couple weeks ago sort of about what's going on. So first, the macro really shifted, but, you know, shifting macro doesn't mean a whole lot till money starts to flow in. And, you know, the money is definitely flowing into our sector. So LPs are putting a lot more money into their specialist hedge funds. Also, there's a lot more inflow now coming into the various healthcare mutual funds. And so it's time for people to do IPOs, and just really strong reception for Kyverna this week. Strong area, obviously, B cell. Be quite interesting to see how, you know, Kyverna plays out against other players such as Cabaletta or Imix. And I like the space quite a lot. And I think we're going to see a lot more IPOs coming in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, and there was also some follow-ons I don't know if you were tracking of those.
I mean, the follow-on market's just crazy. So last month, by my count, we had $6.5 billion in follow-ons. I mean, just to give you a point of comparison, you know, the same month the year before, we saw $1.5 billion. So we're not quite at the level of follow-ons we saw during the pandemic, but you know, we're well on our way there. And you know, the volume of follow-ons, you know, just like this week, it's, I mean, I have a hard time keeping track of them, right? I mean, it's just like three, four, five of them a day, as opposed to three, four, five of them a week. So, you know, this week you saw Asana, huge one from Atlas, Tenaya, Mineralys. Last night we did Sensorion, Evoke. They're coming all day, and we'll see, you know, a lot more to come.
Yeah. Does anybody else want to comment on general market sentiment? And also, I know Chris and Grace, you both sit on boards of private companies as well as public companies and sort of tapped into that private market dynamic.
Yeah, this is all good news. I mean, I think the signs we're all looking for is continued momentum and health. So again, I don't think we're, you know, fully out of the woods yet, but I think we're seeing signs that we don't have to look back as much, and we can look forward to kind of better times ahead through 2024. So yeah, I mean, I'm encouraged by that for both, you know, VC private as well as public companies.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think we're seeing kind of the knock-on effects of that with respect to, you know, the funds getting closed or change in prioritization of how they're investing, and definitely a ton of conversations. The funds themselves are seeing a lot more deal flow. I think people are more optimistic. And both with the IPO market and the expected ramp up in the M&A market, I think, you know, we're cautiously optimistic. I don't think we're completely out of the water yet. And I think it'll take a while for a lot of the smaller companies to really feel the impact of the access to capital. But, you know, we're trying to stay optimistic.
Yeah, and obviously M&A is a big factor. So it was nice to see this MorphoSys deal with Novartis, with all the caveats that we discussed. So one of the themes that it made me think about is pharma companies walking away. And it was announced this week that Gilead will now not acquire immunotherapy biotech company Tizona. They had paid $300 million for the right to do so in 2020, and if they had moved forward, they would have had to pay an additional $1.25 billion. And this is at least a second acquisition option from Gilead that they passed on this year. The other was Pionyr Immunotherapeutics. And pharma companies walking from deals can have a hugely negative impact on a company because of perception issues. And sometimes it's just because of strategic shifts or people moving in the organization. But, you know, arguably, it can be worse if they walk from a program after acquiring it. So, Chris, I'd love to hear your thoughts on Gilead. So, first of all, broadly, how do you think they've done on partnering? They announced this week that they're terminating another clinical trial related to the $4.9 billion acquisition of 47. And then also, I saw that Lilly was terminating a Loxo program. Yeah.
Yeah. So first on Tizona, I think given Gilead's going to retain a 49% equity stake, it's a little bit of the choice of do we continue to throw good money right after bad? Let's wait to. So they still potentially, if Tizona finds success, they could still acquire them and have a really good kind of hedge against a later, you know, acquisition. So I think it probably was the smart move to sit still and not exercise that option. But yeah, so Gilead has not had the best kind of track record in recent years of acquisitions. But just speaking about the 47 acquisition, this is magrolimab. This is the CD47 antibody they paid $5 billion for. And for hematologic malignancies, the drug really hasn't worked. About 6 months ago, they announced that their open label phase three study called ENHANCE-2. That the DSMB said they had a futility analysis and said, look, we're not seeing any efficacy, but they signaled that, hey, we're not really seeing a safety issue either. And so they continued their ENHANCE-3 study, and they just announced that that one not only shows futility, it's not working, but it actually increased death in AML patients. So they announced that many anticipated probably they would do is they just shut down all hematologic malignancies across AML and MDS. Now, the drug still is in early stage, applications for solid tumors, brain cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, urothelial carcinoma. Those are earlier stage development, but it really shows that $5 billion acquisition is not, bearing the fruit. And that was a big hefty price tag at a time where there was a lot of exuberance, I think, around CD47. I think Brad Lonkar, our colleague co-host, said that Trillium will go down as one of the best timed acquisitions. We've had Jan Svarka on this program. So I think that one is really proving to be a challenging, justified acquisition for Gilead. And just before I speak about kind of their other track record, in a similar vein, Lilly paid $8 billion for Loxo, and really around two key products. Bayer had full rights to the other two products that were in their late stage pipeline. One is a BTK inhibitor that got accelerated approval, Jaypicra, that looks like it could have legs in CLL, could be best in class. They're expecting additional expanded indications in CLL. But the RET inhibitor, which is approved, called Retevmo, has been a little bit of an underperformer. So they only did about $250 million in 2023. They announced that they're shutting down their backup RET inhibitor from their pipeline. And so I think, again, this isn't looking like it's justifying that $8 billion price tag. We'll have to see how the BTK inhibitor ultimately performs over the next several years. But it just shows that, look, acquisitions are not easy. You've got a lot of good companies, smart companies that might even be applauded when they make those acquisitions initially. But, there's still a lot of risk in these programs, not just development risk, safety risk, but also commercial performance risk. And Gilead really has become a little bit of a poster child of how much money you can spend. Now, Immunomedics was their largest acquisition in ADC, which has a lot of promise and, still has good, outcomes in some indications, but they had a big failure in lung cancer that was a setback. The stock dropped, 10%, earlier this year on that readout. You see Galapagos, that wasn't all Dan O'Day, but, they put $4 billion into that and really hasn't yielded any fruit. The commercial product they have is really not performed as a blockbuster and didn't get additional indications. Arcus is another company. They kind of doubled down earlier this year on the TIGIT space. Their lead TIGIT stopped a phase 3 lung trial. It seems lung is really a theme here that is really tough to drive success in non-small lung cancer in these new targets. And they dropped a follow-on TIGIT from their pipeline. Gilead did so, but they decided to continue to invest in Arcus with an increased equity stake. So when you look across that and even Kite in retrospect looks like it was a good acquisition to give them a foothold in cancer, but they were even criticized for the amount they paid for Kite and the promise. I think, it still takes a long time to realize revenues in this CAR T space. So overall, when you add up the tens of billions of dollars, that Gilead has spent, it really shows that there's been a value destruction and dilution to kind of their, currency with these acquisitions when you add it all up. I think they generate a lot of cash flow. I remember there was a time when Gilead had a greater than 50% EBITDA operating margin. So, when I was there, I did business development at Gilead. They were very conservative. They never wanted to overpay. And we have to remember, Gilead was pressured for years about what's next. When are you going to do acquisitions? And I'm not saying they succumbed to the analyst pressure, but, they finally did all these deals. But it just shows that sometimes it's the deal you don't do, which is the best strategy. That's kind of a little bit of a retrospective on Gilead.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, Tim, maybe you could do this analysis if you haven't already. It'd be interesting to see different pharma companies and their acquisitions in a similar way to what we just talked about with Gilead. How did those acquisitions pan out for them?
Yeah. Just to make one comment, and I'd love to hear what Grace has to say because she knows Gilead really well too. You know, acquisitions have different risk profiles. So if you buy something commercial, it's just commercial risk. If you buy something clinical, you've got clinical and commercial risk. There's downside and there's upside, right? So, you know, Gilead obviously made a brilliant acquisition with Pharmacit before, and they don't all work out. So, you know, the way I think about it is Gilead really went big into immuno-oncology, and those acquisitions didn't work out. And it turned out that, you know, immuno-oncology was just a lot riskier than maybe everyone thought. But imagine if they did work out. So what's different about immuno-oncology than most targeted oncology is you're taking a pan-tumor type of approach, right? So, you know, there's more risk, but there's also a lot more upside too. And, well, these didn't work out, but it doesn't mean that Dan O'Day was a bad CEO. You know, it might be that history doesn't look favorably on him. It might be that history does look favorably on him. I think that story is still to be told. But I don't personally look at Gilead as a company that, you know, can't make good decisions. I think they just took some risks that didn't play out.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was interesting. And Chris, you know this, right? When we were at Gilead, it was, you know, John and John were quite conservative in terms of looking at exciting things and not really striking until they were later stage. So when we first looked at Pharmacit, it was about $1 billion and that was too expensive for them. But obviously it was much earlier stage and, you know, waiting a few years later and striking for $11 billion and it paid off. But I still remember those commercial strategy models we did that looked at the analyst expectations for growth, because the issue was we were dominant in HIV and HBV and needed new growth areas beyond virology, which is so, so different. I mean, when I was running clinical ops there, trials for HIV are much simpler in terms of endpoints and all of those things. They knew the area really well. When you go into new areas, like when we went into respiratory and cardiology, you know, it was challenging. It's different KOLs, it's different types of trials, different specialty, new sale, integrating new sales forces. So, you know, like every big pharma, they struggle. But, you know, going from that kind of mentality where you're dominant in one area across the board in terms of all the functions and then having to integrate all these new things is always challenging. And on the value of acquisitions, I remember when we developed the Alliance Management Group, we looked at the history of acquisitions and M&A and actually analyses that had been done back then. And not surprisingly, the vast majority of them fail when you compare them to expectations that were the basis for those acquisitions. And so I agree, Tim, it'd be really interesting if you guys could look at, I'm sure somebody has done this, right? Where you look at, this is what we expected to achieve, even risk adjusted for clinical risk. And this is what actually happened. Did we create value or destroy value? So I do think that's a really interesting area to look at.
Yeah, and my bet is that you're going to see a consistent theme that most deals do not perform up to expectations. So Tim, we're really piling a lot on for you to follow up with this one. But Grace, I remember there was a real tension at Gilead for can the organization moved beyond their clear core expertise in virology. And there was almost a discomfort that I remember in the earlier days of getting into these new areas. And, you know, oncology with Kite, having Ari Beldegrun and the kind of legacy there was a good foothold to have credibility in cancer. But as Tim says, immuno-oncology is kind of a different animal here. And, you know, it's really tough to drive success. So, you know, it just shows that you really need to either bring in the core expertise that can provide credibility, including in driving your M&A business development strategy, because, you know, Gilead really didn't perform that well beyond, you know, their original core legacy, you know, virology expertise.
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting themes here. You know, I think one of them, and we should dig into them at another time, but one of them is this concept of the pressure that a company gets from expectations and, you know, how much to take that into account versus just sort of guiding through, you know, whatever feels right to the management of the company. And I think the second theme, which is pretty interesting, is just how much hype or buzz around a certain area can drive interest in M&A. And, you know, one of those areas is obesity right now. So we had a few obesity-related news items this week. Lilly's tirzepatide phase 2 trial for MASH driving volatility in biotech stocks with earlier stage and non-GLP-1 MASH candidates. and then Amgen's weight loss candidate, MariTide, which announced some phase one data. So let's talk about some of the data that was announced this week. Josh, can you start with Amgen, and then Tim, can you cover Lilly after?
Yeah, so Amgen gave another update for their GLP agonist slash GIP antagonist that had again very good weight loss, but there were high rates of GI side effects. And there was also a signal of elevated lipids that I think Eli Lilly responded to a question flagging that as perhaps on the Lilly earnings call, perhaps being related to the GIP antagonist as opposed to GIP agonism, which some of the other constructs like Mounjaro have. So there's always literally every week there's something new happening in the obesity space. The other thing Lilly shared with us was the tirzepatide NASH data showing, perhaps not surprisingly, and really robust effect on NASH activity. We're kind of waiting to see what they can show on fibrosis scores, but presumably a weight loss drug is going to be a very good way to treat fatty liver disease and its complications. And given the price point of the weight loss drugs compared to some of the newer kind of more NASH targeted therapies, whether it's thyroid hormone receptor targeting or FGFR, sorry, FGF agonists, I should say, they're all expected to cost much more. At the same time that the landscape is very rapidly shifting, thanks to these truly amazing weight loss drugs and the effect that they're having on patients. There are some who are thinking that maybe the new NASH therapies, kind of the targeted NASH therapies, will be important for patients who have more severe, more advanced forms of liver disease, maybe for whom, weight loss can't come fast enough. But a very interesting space to watch. There was a bunch of debate as to whether the weight loss drugs would have strong NASH activity, which is kind of hard to understand because it is, I mean, NASH is a disease of excess weight. So I think Lilly started to address that, and we'll look to see how the field evolves from here.
Tim, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, just a comment maybe starting on Amgen. I did read through their paper in Nature Metabolism. I mean, first of all, the Amgen data are stunning, and they're definitely not only competitive with tirzepatide, they're better than tirzepatide. So the Amgen product is very similar to tirzepatide structurally, except it antagonizes, not agonizes, GIP. And if you go through both the genetic data and also the physiology of why GIP antagonism makes sense, I do think Amgen has got a tiger by the tail there. I did note in the paper that they had high rates of nausea and vomiting associated with the higher doses of that drug, which just delivered absolutely stunning reductions in weight in relatively short periods of time. I think it's important to note, as Jay Bradner said on the Amgen conference call, that this is phase one data. That is, Amgen has yet to design sort of run-in dosing. So they just, try different doses in a phase one study. And yeah, at high doses, people vomited. So obviously, that's not where you would start a patient. You're going to start them at a lower dose and then kind of take them up, presumably, to higher doses over time. I think the Amgen approach is really, really interesting. There's some newcos out there that have yet to declare their existence that are also pursuing GIP antagonism. This is going to be a really exciting area. On the Lilly data, Josh, I think you and I are pretty aligned. I mean, the way I think about it is, if you've ever had foie gras, that's just like, force-fed liver fat from a goose or duck. And so, in the extreme, MASH is kind of like human foie gras. And yeah, if you starve a duck, right, the foie gras is going to go away. It happens to be that human livers remodel very quickly. And so, you can make MASH go away. You can make fibrosis go away. I was personally kind of like very skeptical of all the comments being made on Twitter and by analysts saying, well, they don't have fibrosis data. I mean, fibrosis is a result up excess fat in the liver. It just takes time to play out. And so eventually, you know, tirzepatide will be able to show improvements in fibrosis too. That's just going to take some more experimentation. I do think that, you know, the Lilly data is a major problem for a lot of the companies that are going after MASH, NASH, whatever you want to call it on their own. And the GLP-1 class is a just huge game changer for patients with this disease.
Tim, I think everybody is going to be thinking about you when they go out to eat and have foie
gras. Yeah, I never touch foie gras. It's nasty.
Yeah. So speaking of obesity, there was big news this week when Novo Holdings, which is the parent investment company of Novo Nordisk, announced it's going to acquire Catalent for $16.5 billion in cash. Additionally, Novo Nordisk, the drug company, will acquire three manufacturing sites from Novo Holdings for $11 billion. So this deal greatly benefits Novo Nordisk, which has been trying to keep up with the demand for its weight loss drug Wegovy, which is in short supply. After the deal was announced, David Ricks, the CEO of Lilly, who is the biggest competitor to Novo in obesity so far, said the deal was unusual and made a sort of ominous statement. Quote, given the nature of this transaction, a vertical integration where the client list of Catalent might number in excess of 100 entities, all of which plan to compete in some way with Novo Nordisk, it sets up for an interesting inquiry by everybody, including politicians, end quote. So the deal also raised concerns among other large and small drug companies that use Catalent as a manufacturing contractor. So Novo Holdings responded to all the backlash by saying that they're going to be honoring agreements with current customers and employees to ensure that you know, everybody will remain unaffected by the change. But this is an interesting situation because we have an investment firm that has a vested interest in one drug company now having access to contracts and, you know, potentially proprietary information about other companies. I assume there'll be a wall, including competitors. So, Chris, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this deal.
Yeah, if we think about broadly service organizations, whether they be, you know, CDMOs or CROs, they're dealing with this every day, right? They have multiple clients. Often there's competition. They wouldn't last very long with credibility if they could not keep a firewall. We just sold Forge Therapeutics in the gene therapy space. You know, that was raised as a major issue, and it just was not, you know, an issue at all, right? Because you have contracts with specific companies. We all know who followed Novo Holdings versus Novo Nordisk. There's been a pretty kind of bright line between those two, their strategies. They often, when we hope that if Novo has an interest, would Novo Holdings invest? And, you know, they've been pretty clear that they're very different, distinct strategies. Novo Holdings is a financial, right, organization that has specific things. And by the way, this is no different than every company thinks about where they typically outsource their manufacturing until they realize they have a real commercial blockbuster on their hands. And very common to go in and acquire. I remember, you know, Grace, in the earlier days of Gilead, small molecule, we acquired a bunch of manufacturers because it improves the margin, right? There's a lot of reasons that you want to own those manufacturing facilities. So I really don't see the major issue. I think if this wasn't the biggest class ever and it wasn't highly competitive, I think that's raised the specter of this. But I actually don't see a major concern. And if this was on a smaller scale, I don't think this would be even a topic of discussion. Now, again, you know, we'd have to speculate that there was something nefarious going on. But I think that, you know, if you know, Catalent continues to contract with companies, they're setting themselves up for lawsuits if they say, oh, sorry, we don't have capacity, we can't deliver. You know, they're putting a lot at risk that they could be sued for this, you know, what might be the ominous, you know, wording of some kind of anti-competitive, right, posturing here by the Lilly CEO. So that's my perspective on it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I know there was a lot of smaller companies scrambling just to make sure that none of the, the manufacturing sites that they were using were affected by it. But I tend to agree with you. I do think that this is going to create some scrutiny, you know, probably from the FTC and potentially others. So, Grace, you've been tracking the Vertex vanzatriple data. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Sure. This is an area, as Chris knows, we first looked at CF when we acquired Bruce Montgomery's company at Gilead many, many years ago. So I haven't been following the field as closely as back then, but this one was particularly interesting for a number of reasons, given Vertex's string of recent good news. So they had trials that were, these are pivotal trial results that came out of their new combo therapy called the Vanza combo, which is a triple combo of Vanza Captor, Texacaftor, and Dutifacaf. And it's basically the only common element of that with Trikafta, their big blockbuster triple combo therapy, is the Texacaftor. So they did three trials. Two were randomized controlled trials, 1-year trials in patients 12 years and above, and one was a single arm study in patients 6 to 11 years old. And the two pivotal trials in adults were slightly different populations in terms of the mix of genetic backgrounds related to key mutations impacting CFTR, which is the key misfunctional protein in CF. And all arms started with a 4-week run-in on Trikafta, and then that's when baseline measurements were taken. And what the bottom line is, the primary endpoint in was actually non-inferior to Trikafta, which was the change from baseline in percent predicted forced expiratory volume in 1 second, or PPFE1. But I think the interesting data was in the key secondary endpoints that were related to sweat chloride. Now, this endpoint was first used in development of Kalydeco or Ivacaftor back in 2014, and it's a diagnostic that's used commonly for diagnosis, where you look at, you know, carriers exhibit a level of sweat chloride, between 30 millimolar liters and 60 millimolar per liters, and then once you're above 60, that's a definite positive diagnosis. And obviously, this is a good measurement because the CFTR protein, it regulates ion flux in the surface of certain epithelial cells. And all of these therapies revolve around restoring defective CFTR ion transport. Various combinations address slightly different mutations or in different ways. This is very exciting because if you look at the combination of the data in the two pivotal trials in adults, there was about a 2 times greater likelihood in the odds of achieving sweat chloride levels below 60 millimolar than with Trikafta, and about a 3 times greater likelihood in the odds of achieving, below 30 millimolar for those treated with Vanza. And the results were even better in children. This is a great endpoint because it's, easy to use, but it also can be used, it's not that easy to measure. You have to set up a little measurement on the skin and you look at electrical conduction and so forth. But what's interesting about it is because you can track it very early. It can be measured consistently in any age, and the sweat glands, unlike the lungs and other organs, don't get impacted. So it's really exciting data. They announced this data, Trikafta reached almost 9 billion in 2023 and is expected to go over 10 billion. And some of the analysts are predicting a similar peak revenue for the Vanza triple. However, when this news came out, the stock dropped a little bit, but this was on the heels of their earnings report. And so people are still waiting to see how some of their other therapies and launches are going to do. So we'll wait to see what happens. But overall, this is really good news for patients, and they intend to file later this year.
Oh, thanks, Grace. Josh, I noticed that you were getting a lot of kudos this week regarding a call that you made regarding 4D molecular therapeutics.
It was an interesting week for 4D. They reported over the weekend their phase 2 data for their gene therapy product for treatment of wet AMD. And on the surface, the data looks exceptional. There's a 90% reduction in need for subsequent anti-VEGF injections in these patients, which can be quite cumbersome. But I think we've flagged how challenging wet AMD trials can be to interpret in the past. It's a little bit of a cesspool of poor clinical trial design or trial designs that are in many ways gamed to make drugs look far better than they are. And so then on closer inspection, when you look at the reinjection criteria that they used, they might have been extremely loose. And perhaps that explains why there was such a dramatic reduction in need for anti-VEGF injections. And then it just kind of makes it very hard to figure out what's happening in that data set. So the stock gapped up pretty significantly when the data first came out, but it's retraced partly as investors are starting to appreciate that, in wet AMD trials, the devil's in the details, and in this case as well, very hard to really understand what this what's happening with this signal. The stock's up a little bit today. Now, coincidentally, this week, Adverum gave us data for their wet AMD gene therapy product. And, on the efficacy front, I think Adverum made a better case with their data that their gene therapy is getting good exposure levels and good efficacy. However, they're struggling a little bit more with intraocular inflammation. That really wasn't an issue for 4D, perhaps because 4D's dose was just, substantially lower to the point of having perhaps more unclear efficacy, whereas Adverum dosed higher, I think a stronger case for efficacy, but to manage the ocular inflammation, they're going ahead with Ozurdex and topical steroid drops. So Adverum shares gapped up earlier in the week after a private placement where investors were under certain terms allowed to see the data and make their investment decision off of that. That's somewhat controversial practice. It's a legal practice. Some object, others don't object to it. So based on a premium private placement for new investors, shares moved up considerably with the assumption that those investors saw something that they really liked. But since the data, Adverum stock has also started to retrace. It's still well up from where it started the week, but a whole bunch of moving parts in this wet AMD space that, I've been following this space since the days of Macugen. I think I mentioned that last time. And there are all sorts of nuances that one has to really appreciate when interpreting the data to get a clear sense as to the active or activity profile of a drug.
Yeah, thanks, Josh.
I just wanted to make a comment, which is, I'll defer to Josh on the data, but the old saying, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. This week, we saw two companies, not one, report gene therapy data for the first time in a really big disease. This is a big deal for gene therapy and more generally for the use of nucleic acid change therapies. Really the first time that we've seen something really work well in a large indication. And I think it points to a lot of potential for this field in the future.
Yep, it's a great point. And also, I think a bigger pressure on the adverse event profile as you get into these bigger diseases. So, Grace and Chris, have you been following the J&J phase 3 data with nipocalimab?
Yeah. So first, just to stick with the Gilead theme, I just wanted to highlight that John Milligan is the executive chair of 4DMT or 4D Molecular Therapeutics. So, and he doesn't take many roles, post-Gilead. And then also on the ITEC, Grace remembers this, but that was actually the ITEC Aptamer was from a Gilead acquisition, which we divested and sold to ITEC. So I wasn't on that call, and I was thinking in my head, wow, I wish I was on there. But anyway, regarding J&J, I just to highlight, they announced two readouts on indications for generalized myasthenia gravis as well as Sjogren's disease. This is the FcRn class of drugs where Many have touted this as kind of the next TNF-alpha type class. They've already seen a lot of success. I think Argenx, which we've talked about a lot on Hangout, one of the most successful European companies, is driven largely on being the first in class in this, burgeoning category. But many believe that J&J, is developing theirs with an eye toward being best in class. You know, we know Humira wasn't the first to market, but turned out to be the biggest in the class of TNFs. And so I think we're seeing the signs of where this class can go. And I think J&J is being kind of very aggressive in going after their clinical strategy to really turn this third to market. UCB has another FcRn antibody that's approved. So I think this is one to watch. I think this is going to be a large class that we're going to hear more and more about. I think it's been a little bit overshadowed by the GLP-1s and kind of the blockbuster status of the obesity class of drugs. But, I think we'd be paying a lot more attention to this FcRn space, but I think people are recognizing that this is going to be a big, big class.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Chris.
I'm just in general excited about the fact that we're finally seeing progress in this huge unmet need of Sjogren's. And I'm hoping this is one of many in the trends we're seeing in autoimmune diseases, which disproportionately impact women. And Tim, I was glad to see that you highlighted that in your report, as well as the Cell paper about the exciting data looking at, I guess it's pronounced EXIST, the ribonucleoproteins that are shown that could have a big role to play in why autoimmune diseases greatly disproportionately impact women. And this has been an area that's been really hard to develop drugs. Everything in Sjogren's, lupus, and there's been very, very little progress, nothing really new approved in a long time. And now between this and the focus on taking cell therapy into these areas, with the big Kyverna IPO yesterday, I sit on the board of CureDx with Peter Maag, so I was thrilled to see his company do so well, and we have high hopes for that. So overall, I'm just extremely excited. I think this is going to be a year where we're going to see a lot of advances across women's health broadly. And I agree with you, Chris, in terms of this class, this is very exciting news.
I would just add there are a couple of other mechanisms to keep a close eye on when it comes to myasthenia gravis or some of the other indications where the FcRn antibodies have shown activity, because there is room for improvement in either in terms of efficacy and or delivery convenience. So we're watching both Roche and Tourmaline with their IL-6 antibodies. We're kind of seeing a reawakening of IL-6 targeting as a mechanism, where companies had made some initial advances in rheumatoid arthritis and some other immune-mediated diseases. But some of the signals that we're seeing from that mechanism, very promising when it comes to diseases like myasthenia gravis. Also watching, Amgen has a phase 3 readout of Uplinza, their CD19 antibody in myasthenia gravis. So between those, the FcRns, and the CAR-T, this is turning into a little bit of a battle royale of very various mechanisms. So this is a really important year.
Yep, it's great for patients when this kind of thing happens, and sort of a battle, but on behalf of patients. So I was intrigued by some news this week about the FDA modernizing the way it tracks drugs after they come to market and using AI. Grace, do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, and thanks for bringing this to our attention, because this kind of flew under the radar a little bit in terms of this was presented at a conference, a kind of obscure conference, which is the Drug Industry Association's Pharmacovigilance Conference. And I used to attend the IA meetings because they're very focused on overall development operations, clinical operations, regulatory, and all that. And they presented that they're looking at using AI tools to basically do post-marketing surveillance. The reporter went on to say, this came out in Endpoints, that they're first going to look at it to deploy a deduplication algorithm for adverse event reports. And, you know, this has always been a challenge. I mean, they look at millions of safety-related adverse events every year, and the disparity and the quality of the data, how do you sift through that? How do you interpret it? But obviously, they're using more and more tools. But an interesting comment he made in the presentation is that the AI and human combo may not be better than just humans. And the reason he says that is that there's a research paper that found that humans alone did better than humans and AI on on electronic manufacturing quality control, and that the difference is due to the concept of what he calls social loafing, where humans work less hard thinking the algorithm will do the bulk of the work. So I thought it was interesting that he said that, but they're definitely making a big push into AI. He didn't give a lot of details about how exactly this would be rolled out. But definitely there's been, Calif has talked about this a lot recently. Last year, they published a paper on the use of AI and machine learning in drug development and trying to figure out, how are they gonna look at this and the impact of that down the line. And then they also launched a digital health advisory committee, really being managed by CDRH to help Calif on all the issues related to AI, machine learning, digital, and all of that. And I think that's really interesting at a time. I think last week or a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the impact of digital tools, wearables, some of these novel exploratory endpoints that are looking at the integration of data coming from wearables and digital technologies. So this is an area, it's good to see that they're being active about this. It remains to be seen what the details will be. They also continue to work on their the multi-year modernization of their REMS program. So there's a lot going on, and we expect to see a lot more going on in the future. I think it's still early days, just like pharma. They're still trying to figure it out, but we'll definitely keep our eyes on that.
Yeah, it's fascinating because there's so many ways that AI is going to impact drug development, whether it be in drug discovery or these, biomarkers and, just this idea of doing better adverse event tracking. And so I think we're just at the cusp. And also AI is getting smarter all the time. So I predict that the human element is going to become less and less important in some of these areas. Anyway, it's really interesting and fascinating to track it. So, one of the things that we track every once in a while is new investors that come on the scenes. And Sion Life Sciences launched a new $310 million fund with the co-founder of RayzeBio and other industry veterans. Chris, I know you're really deep into this private funding landscape. Any thoughts on it?
The two guys who kind of launched this new fund, Sam Hall and Aaron Kantoff, they were both formerly at AppleTree. They were pretty well known. I think they did some really good work when they were at AppleTree. Aaron went on to help Medici for a time, but I think everybody knew that they were looking to kind of build their own fund and strategy. And kind of similar to what I did when I joined Perceptive Advisors, which was a multi-stage kind of hedge fund crossover investor, but they had not done much early venture. Sion kind of partnered with Petrichor, which is kind of a larger healthcare private equity firm. I have to say, when our fellow VCs look at new fund launches, I think I at least marvel on the marketing and positioning. So, when you kind of read, it sounds like a new strategy, a new vision. I think again, with all I think they're sincere about it, but the positioning of, hey, we're going to carry these products all the way to the cusp of or through commercialization is a little challenging on a venture strategy. I mean, typically there's a right time to exit when you're a venture. They highlighted that we want to build companies that are bought, not sold, and we'll continue to build the next Regeneron. And so I think some people were confused about, is this a venture fund that's going to try to carry companies privately through commercialization? And I think it was just that the idea that they want to focus on things that are closer to the clinic, more product driven, like the entire market sentiment has shifted from kind of early platform discovery to we want to see data in real products. And so again, you know, I think we're all, I think you're looking at venture capitalists that have been around for a while that have started their own fund. And I think all of us are looking to collaborate with them, co-invest with them. And, you know, it's nice to see veterans kind of come together in launching a new fund.
It's always funny to see how, you know, the trends in the market, you know, they get sort of captured and are communicated through PR. So, you know, the idea that the market has shifted towards later stage products, I think is an important one, but really shouldn't, you know, venture capitalists should really be doing whatever they think is going to make sense in, you know, 3 to 5 years time, as opposed to worrying about like what the current market conditions are. I mean, I guess, I don't know. Are they more crossover? Or are they more venture in your mind?
Well, no. So Petrichor is more private equity. So I think the idea is that, hey, let's leverage earlier stage companies where valuations are lower. You can drive, you know, look, you can drive good returns across the spectrum, right? I mean, we know, you know, hedge funds can drive great returns, even though they're dealing with public companies that are of high, you know, higher valuations typically. So I think you can, if you're good at the different stages of investment, you can drive, you know, good returns across the board. But I think I tend to favor, because when I launched, you know, the Zontogeny and the Perceptive Venture Funds, it was with the idea that, hey, let's be capital efficient with product-driven stories. And I think the industry would benefit if we were kind of more willing to be data-driven in terms of our valuations. And, you know, there's a lot of VCs, and I'll sound a little cynical here, that the goal is hey, let's build value and let's get out before we have the big binary clinical readout, which could make it go to zero or to lose all of the money that we've, you know, value we've created. And I think, you know, we've said from the beginning, hey, we're expecting to hold our investments through those big clinical readouts, right? Because if we have the courage of our convictions, we think that the best value will be, you know, to get that clinical data set. And so I think, you know, Scion Life Sciences, I think, is definitely in that camp that we want to, you know, expect to hold our investment or continue to invest, you know, through these big clinical readouts. And that's what typically would drive M&A, is when a pharma or big biotech sees an asset that's de-risked, that, okay, we might need to do additional studies, we might need to do pivotal to get it across the finish line, but we think this has a much higher likelihood of being approved and generating revenue. Now, we've talked earlier in this episode about how difficult that can still be when you, you know, acquire a company for often billions that, based on, you know, clinical data that doesn't necessarily follow through with that blockbuster potential. But I think, you know, again, I applaud VCs that are willing to kind of bet on things and carry those investments through a clinical readout in patients.
Yeah, and I know Arch and Sofinnova tend to do that. Like they hold for a really long time, and they also buy in a post IPO, which I think is a great way to measure how, you know, the, as you mentioned, the conviction that they have with regard to whatever company they're backing. Tim, do you have any thoughts on this? And then maybe we can go around and make closing remarks, because we're almost at the end of the show.
I mean, I'm big fans of these guys and also the Petrichor team, and I kind of congratulate all of them for teaming up in this way. Petrichor's got just an incredible network of external advisors that they can kind of put to work for the Scion team and vice versa. So I think it's very synergistic. It's actually surprising to me that we don't see more multi-strategy approaches. I, you know, obviously Perceptive's gone that way. OrbiMed's gone that way. I think there's a lot of potential here. You know, just one other comment, which is, you know, some VCs just somehow seem to do better. So, you know, Sam Hall, Aaron Kantop, those guys haven't made a lot of mistakes. And some people just are, you know, really good at identifying opportunities and taking advantage of them. And I think those guys are a, sort of that phenotype. And so there's a ton of potential with this group.
Yeah, well, we welcome them and another player making investments in important new biotech companies. So congratulations to them on the fund. So let's go around and make closing remarks as we're very close to the end of time. Josh, do you have any thoughts on anything that we've talked about today or anything else?
Yeah, great discussion overall. I'm probably a little less bullish than most on the sector overall, just given the appreciation we've seen in the XBI over the past few months. But that said, I'm as bullish as ever on much more selective opportunities within biotech. There's tremendous still dislocation in valuations that have not yet corrected. Companies with de-risked assets or increasingly de-risked assets trading as though they're high risk assets, and that's kind of the fun of what we do, is trying to find those opportunities and shed a little bit of light on them.
Grace?
Yeah, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, I am extremely excited about women's health. I do see, since the beginning of the year, we've seen a number of things that are pretty exciting in terms of whether it's an autoimmune or whether it's an actually disease that only impact women. It's going to be very interesting. We've established a women's health task force at Bio, and we're actively, we have one of the CSO of Bio is involved in the Gates Foundation effort that was published last year. We have the McKinsey report that is highlighting a number of trends and really spurring a lot of discussion. And we have the whole mifepristone case. Just this week, three studies that were used by the plaintiffs in the case against mifepristone were retracted because it was found out that the authors and one of the peer reviewers had conflict of interest. They were related with the pro-life subset of the American Association of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. So I think that's going to add some weight to the discussions that will happen later in March with regards to mifepristone in the Supreme Court. So overall, I'm pretty bullish about this area and always happy to talk to people if people want to chat about women's health. I know Google Ventures is increasing their investment in that area, and a number of other funds are beginning to carve out specific investment opportunities in this area, not just in therapeutics, but across the board in diagnostics and medical device, as well as digital health. So stay tuned. I know, Daphne, we're going to be hopefully addressing this in the future as well in future episodes.
Yeah, thanks so much, Grace. Tim, and then we'll have Chris close out the room.
Yeah, just to echo Grace's comments, I always like look at what's going on the science side. So there's no doubt that there's been underinvestment, I think, scientifically, whether you look at it at pharma or at the level of the NIH, in female predominant disease. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, women do have their unfair share of disease burden. And so just in the last, 6-7 months, we've seen some major breakthroughs. So including a scientist, Marlena Fejo, published a paper showing that hyperemesis gravidarum, which is a huge affliction in pregnancy, uncontrolled vomiting associated with pregnancy, not your normal morning sickness, appears to be caused by a hormone called GDF-15. Then NGM Bio, soon after that publication, biotech companies that many people have kind of forgotten about, has an antibody that can directly address that pathology. So that's really exciting. Another group of scientists in Japan showed that endometriosis, which impacts over 10% of women in their lifetime, appears to be caused by a bacteria. Sort of crazy. So we found that out last year. And then there's been a lot of work on this kind of idea that women are disproportionately impacted by depression. So the odds that a woman becomes depressed is about twice as high as the odds that a man becomes depressed. Most people attribute it somehow to sex hormones. In fact, you'll even hear the phrase sometimes, she's hormonal, which is, obviously a bit derogatory. And we now are starting to understand better why that happens. And so I think there's been a lot of work around a GPCR called GPR158 that appears to be implicated. It's very responsive to estrogen and is also now known to be involved in the depression response. And then finally, as Grace said last week, this kind of stunning paper out of Stanford and the KTH in Sweden kind of finds out a very simple explanation for, why we have 8 times more lupus in women than in men. And so, to me, I think the science is really starting to look very exciting. And I would hope that, 5-10 years from now, we look back and say, 2023, 2024, those were great years for change in women's health.
Well, Tim, that was a deep tutorial in closing comment.
I'm all over this topic, if you can't tell.
Yeah, really appreciate that.
By the
way,
Josh came to visit me the other day, and I just drowned him in women's health stuff. So, like, I'm all over it.
Yeah. Well, Daphne, look, I know week to week, sometimes it can seem like a lot of negative news. I'm pretty encouraged by kind of the topics we discussed, you know, despite the perils of paying billions of dollars for M&A that don't always work out. I think, you know, Tim highlighting the follow-on offerings, I think we've got some big classes, and I think competition is good when we see a lot of companies chasing the same space, whether it's GLP-1s, whether it's FcRn, the gene therapy readouts. We saw the wet AMD space, which is, you know, really a huge opportunity with a lot of people going after. I think, you know, overall, I'm feeling more positive. I tend to be in Josh's camp where I'm more cautiously optimistic and less sanguine on how quickly we can get out of this. But this week, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of bright signs for our sector and very encouraging.
Thanks so much, Chris. And thanks to the co-hosts today, Josh Schimmer, Tim Loeffler, Chris Garabedian, and Grace Colon. I hope everybody has a nice weekend, and we'll see you next week on Biotech Hangout. Thank you.
Great. Thanks,
Daphne.
Thanks. Bye.